Welcome to Authenticate This, the cybersecurity leadership podcast for CISOs and identity leaders navigating the complex world of identity. From real-life breaches to internal missteps and everything in between, we bring you authentic stories, hard-earned lessons, and actionable insights to help you lead with confidence when chaos strikes. Our goal is to humanize identity, uncover actionable solutions, and explore the business of identity beyond the spreadsheet. This is Authenticate This, where identity meets leadership. Hi, this is episode 3 of Authenticate This. I'm Tim, and we've got Aaron as your host, and we have a very special guest today, Julie Meyerholtz. Before we introduce Julie and let her take off, I would love to tell a quick introduction story. So, Julie, thank you for being here. We really appreciate you coming on. When we decided to reach out to you, it was unanimous. In fact, our marketing team, Aaron and myself, we put a list together of all of the types of guests that we would like to have on. And you were at the top of Aaron's list because of a personal relationship and many of the things that you guys have done together. But you are also at the top of my list for one very specific reason. So we met late 2022. We were at Octane, and you were speaking at a CISO dinner that IC Consult had put on. And I recall this dinner specifically because I looked you up as the speaker. We had never met before. And I read an article that was written about you in Medium. This came out kind of mid-year 2022. And in the article, there was a couple of questions, and it talked about the three character traits that bring success to you and to your role. And the first character trait was being a good storyteller. And I remember being wowed by that trait because you're highly technical, obviously a CISO, and you're the CISO at Brunswick. We'll let you speak about that. But as a CISO, you are surrounded by technical people, but you have to influence non-technical people. So the fact that you listed storyteller as your number one trait was amazing. The second trait was authenticity. And that resonated with me as well, because in order to lead people, you need to be authentic. And finally, the last trait was learn fast and learn always. And I kind of lumped that in with learning quickly and failing quickly, right? And so if you go through the article, it talks about how you use those three character traits to be successful into your role as CISO. And I personally got to witness it. So when you got up to speak, we were probably 20 minutes into a dinner and we're in Vegas. Everyone's at a big event. We're already drinking cocktails. As you know, those dinners, the volume starts to get louder and louder and louder. And it got to a point where in that room, we couldn't hear each other. But when you stood up and started talking, everybody got quiet. Everybody listened. Everybody paid attention. Predominantly men, right? CISOs. I think we talked about this yesterday on the prep call. Only 5% or fewer are women CISOs. The rest are all men. So you are clearly a minority within the CISO group. However, you are the top leader, and the way that you commanded the room was mesmerizing. And so that's why I was really excited to have you on, because I got to witness greatness and I got to witness you tell some amazing stories. I still remember the details of that story. I don't want to tell it because it may come up today, but it was captivating, memorable. Here we are two years later. I still remember those details. And so without further ado, Julie Meyerholtz, welcome to Authenticate This. And Aaron, I'm going to let you take over from the questioning.
Julie, thanks for joining. We got to meet each other, I don't know, four years ago now, I think. Yeah, it's been a minute where we worked on a project together. We'll get into this some, I'm sure, but you taught me a lot about how to push change in an organization, even if it means being a bit disruptive. That's the only way to be able to make things positive. As part of that, I got to meet lots of other people, and most recently, Corey, who we just did a podcast with, who you also helped mentor. He and I talked a lot about the process. One of the things we asked him, and I think we're going to try to ask all of our guests now, what is your superpower? I think Corey and I had a good idea of what we thought it might be for you. For him, it was fire. He had a whole bit around that. The guy can put out lots of fires. So cool guy. But from your perspective, what is your superpower?
Yeah, no, it's funny you mentioned Corey. We worked together for a long time, and I really enjoyed seeing him grow in his career as well. So for my superpower, I think Tim hit on it a little bit. I think of the storytelling and analogy, taking complex technical things and making them into something that people can understand by telling the story in terms of things that you do every day. So when we talk about cybersecurity and information security on a regular basis, when I'm in a board meeting or when I'm discussing it with other people, we're not talking about cybersecurity. We may be talking about home security and how these things that we're trying to do map over to home security, or how healthcare is similar to your cyber hygiene, and just various approaches to trying to take the technical out of it. So we're not speaking nerd terms, like in eyes start to glaze over, right? And actually talking in terms that people can understand from their day-to-day lives.
Yeah, that's good. And it lines up with what Corey and I talked about too. And it was somehow you're able to just really influence people. And probably that's part of the story, but just your ability to attract people into conversations. I quickly realized, let me tell you a story. I mean, everybody who listened to the first podcast knew that I was in theater at one point. The person I learned early on from was the owner of a theater company. And in theater, everybody's very entitled. Like, you've got your sort of job and it's like, I don't know, you kind of feel important for being like the producer. And so that's what she was. She was the owner of this company. She couldn't hang lights. She couldn't run a soundboard. But what she could do whenever we were in these tech rehearsals all day is she could sweep the floors. We had people who could sweep the floors, but she always swept the floors in her breaks. She was always present and always doing whatever task she could do to support the show and to show everybody that she was there. And that's clearly what you did on your projects when I worked with you, is that you were willing to do the grunt work, the sweeping the floors, as well as lead. And with that, it became not just for me, but for my whole team. And I could see it in the team at your enterprise that anybody would follow you to war because you were going to be there for us as well as show us the right direction. So to me, that was a really good superpower for you, is just being an influencer in a lot of ways, just the Captain America of the team diving in.
Captain America of the team.
Yeah, the Captain America theme. I like Captain America, so
yeah.
I watched the new one. Sam as Captain America is really great. So anyway, I won't totally nerd out. But anyway, so with that superpower, you know, it seems so just part of you. Did you come to that naturally? Is it something that you like sort of chose to enhance along the way?
I think it's something that grew over time, if that makes sense. I don't think I always was a good storyteller or articulating things. And I think when I started out in consulting, I learned some of those skills along the way because you're having to tell the story to your client, you're having to tell the story to the board and those types of things. But I think it really wasn't until I finished my master's degree in Michigan and some of the leadership skills lessons that we learned there that helped me, you know, formulate those skills. And it's funny you talk about the influencing class or the influencer, because there was one specific class I took through the University of Michigan that was all about how do you influence people and how do you do it in a positive way, that I think a lot of lessons that I've learned from that helped me along the way.
If somebody wanted the same superpower, it sounds like there's some amount of probably natural ability, but it sounds like it's something that can be learned with some amount of time, experience, and sort of training yourself to do it.
I think so. I think anybody can do it, but I mean, you've got to have a foundation of being able to articulate things and understand the technical and the non-technical.
That's always very surprising, is sometimes I'll talk to the CISO without, I won't name any names, but they put on this presence of knowing everything, but you ask them a question and it turns out like it's an inch deep. They don't have the true knowledge behind it all. And I quickly realized I could not fool you, which also created a better partnership, right? Because like we could be open and honest through the process. But man, you come into a room and you ask questions and it was just like, oh, she really knows what she's talking about. It was really great.
You're going on to that lifelong learner that Tim talked about earlier. Yeah, I didn't know anything about identity in 2016. And I had a great manager who reported into me that he influenced me and sold me on the future of identity and taught me everything I know. And so, you know, it was one of those things I learned along the way and I put my trust in him. And honestly, because I did that, when COVID hit, we were way ahead in our security profile because identity was on the cloud. We had least privilege. We had a number of different things in place that a lot of companies didn't have. And I owe that all to him and his lessons.
That's awesome. Yeah. And working with you and stuff, I've noticed you seem to be fairly passionate about what you do. What does that come from in your career? Is it tied to being passionate about security? Is it about being a leader? What would you say your passion is and what's built that passion over your career?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. I jokingly still have a book on my bookshelf called Hacking Exposed, Volume 2. I don't know if you remember those from like 1995. Back in the day, I think I always had an interest in security, but I never really knew that was where I was going to go. It wasn't an opportunity. It wasn't something that was a career, you know, as I was coming up and entering the workforce. And so I entered PwC as a consultant in IT risk. And the longer I was there, the more passionate I became about, okay, this is cool, it's managing risk. And then there's these technical things in cyber. And what I really like about cyber is it's different every day. When you walk in the door, you don't know what you're going to get. Because one day it could be a bunch of meetings, but the next day it could be 5 investigations on compromised accounts or, you know, something else going on. So the fact that it changes every day is one of the things that I really like. But one of the other things I like is the mentoring and growing and developing people in the industry. We don't have enough people in cybersecurity. There's a lot of people with interest in it. There's a lot of people that really have the skill sets but don't believe they do. Like, I'll give you an example. I was talking to a bartender. She came up to me at the WSETH conference and I asked her, like, what are your skills? What have you been doing? Because she clearly had been working for a number of years. And she's like, I have no skills. I'm a bartender. I'm like, that's not true. You have a lot of skills that can apply to cybersecurity and pressure, time under pressure, you know, knowing how to do things in a repetitive manner. There's a lot of different skill sets that you can apply from other careers and move them into cybersecurity. So helping people understand that, develop them and grow and help expand in your workforce is another thing I'm pretty passionate about.
That's good. As I think about that, like I watch my wife, who's a school teacher, teach children, and like that job's tough, but there's so much of it, like just the management and understanding people, being patient, all of that stuff is a big part that I think we do in our jobs. I don't know how to tell somebody how to transition into security. Like if you're trying to talk to somebody new, wanting to get in the field, is it like, hey, you got to go get a degree in it? You got to go get certified? Is it got to find a buddy, go work help desk? How would you tell them to get started?
Yeah, I think there's a few different ways about it. Like, cyber degrees did not exist when I was doing my undergrad. And so this girl with an accounting degree somehow find her way into a CISO role, which never was expected when I was coming out of college, right? I never would have thought about it. I think for people trying to get in the industry, it's more, you don't have to have a degree in it. I think it's more taking some time to do some training to understand the industry. Get into programs like WSETH, or I know there's other ones out there as well, like SAND has some things you could do. Just get into the programs to start networking and learning fundamental skills, but also, you know, taking the leap. Because if I would prefer somebody with fewer cyber skill set that's a fast learner and wants to do the job versus somebody that doesn't or has a cyber experience, but isn't necessarily willing to continue to learn and willing to continue to put the effort in overall. So, you know, it's really be a fast learner, be okay with failing potentially and learning along the way. And, you know, try to find a mentor, somebody that will help give you guidance and teach you various skills along the way.
I can imagine you being coming out of college with your accounting degree. Julie Meyerholtz, most likely to be a CISO. It's like, it's hard to jump that way. So I've quoted you in saying that to not view or don't view cyber as a risk. When you've built presentations and you've talked to upward leadership as the board, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, so you're asking why I don't view cybersecurity as an enterprise risk. I do find it ironic and I understand the irony in it because every company has cybersecurity listed as an enterprise risk. And I think it's right, but it also, cybersecurity to me is a lot like a tornado. You know, if you look at the tornado, it can be very impactful. It can be not impactful. It could take out a tree. It could take out a building, right? And you just never know even if you are going to have a tornado. It could be yesterday or today. It may not be until 6 years from now. Who knows, right? And if you look at a cybersecurity event, it's very similar. You don't know, like, I can have an event that's a compromised account. We shut it down in 2 hours and nobody knows anything about it and it's fine. Or you can have a massive ransomware attack or a massive breach that loses IP and other things. So the way I look at risk is more of what are the enterprise risks to the company? One of them may be can you continue manufacturing? If we can't manufacture, we can't sell, we can't actually make money. So what are the cyber risks that can make that occur, which potentially could be a ransomware attack happens at the manufacturing plant? Just like a tornado could hit that manufacturing plant and take it out, and we can no longer produce whatever product we're manufacturing, right? And so when I approach a company and come into a new role, because this is my third CISO role, whether or not that's good, I don't know. But the first thing I do with my team is look at what are the enterprise risks to the business and where can cyber play a role in those risks? And you're not going to find cyber in all the risks. You know, we're talking about tariffs and changes in that cyber really won't necessarily impact those changes, government, you know, risk, but it will impact manufacturing. It will impact supply chain. And how do you map and measure the cyber risk to those enterprise level risks and then create a program within risk tolerance levels to manage those risks?
That's really cool. So, because like you say, it, the most important thing is manufacturing, more so than maybe, and it can depend on the company, but on their own public brand. So sure, if they get breached, whatever, but if it shuts down manufacturing, that's the real issue. It certainly can help you know where to spend your money as a CISO too, because budgets aren't unlimited. That's a really cool way to look at it. I know we've talked to lots of other CISOs who are just like, I have to have a tool and I got to have this tool because it's really cool and it does X, Y, Z, but not really applying it back to the same company. So I really appreciate that thought process for sure. Okay, so you talked earlier a little bit about, so hey, if I'm coming in new to the industry, you're going to fail along the way. As Tim's talked about in earlier podcasts, is that often failures can turn into success stories with the right amount of reflection and the right amount of action post-failure. Do you have any failure stories where you've learned that, and turned them into success stories throughout your career?
Actually, I think this goes back to the superpower a little bit too, and what we were talking about earlier. So yeah, like every good technical CISO, I come into the role and I'm like, what matters? What should metrics should we looking at? And my team like pulling up all these metrics of things of how many emails we've blocked, how many firewall attempts have the firewall blocked, and all these things. And I'm looking at it, and I'm like, okay, cool. We'll take this up to the executive team and, you know, just kind of show them all the cool things we're doing. And then I go to the executive team and they're like, so you're blocking millions of things with your firewall. What does that tell me? And I'm like, you're right. The only thing that tells you is that we blocked something and nothing happened here. And so like that was a very failed meeting. We went in there with the technical metric that we're looking at. And honestly, I don't even look at blocked firewalls anymore because I don't care. It doesn't matter. It didn't come in my network, but we were looking at it from a very technical perspective, like, hey, look at all these cool things we're doing. And that's some of my learnings along the way of, well, really, this is it. Like, they don't care. They only care if the business is interrupted. So what should I be showing them to show, like, here's your risks and here's what we're doing to prevent those risks from happening, and learn that storytelling over time.
Okay, so that's pretty insightful way to look into that. I think a lot of people who would listen to this podcast aren't probably going to jump into it. It seems obvious that you should not have to just present numbers only to the board, but that's what you do every day. And so you want to be able to brag about what you do to the board. But if they don't care, it's like selling car insurance on the phone to somebody who doesn't have a car, or your Nissan Rogue has got a recall, but you don't have a Nissan Rogue, right? Like those kind of those things. Like, so the board doesn't really care about that. So that, I just wanted those who are listening to really sit in on that of like, how do I message to a specific audience, which Julie talked about earlier, about just storytelling and matching up that. I am curious though, like, how do you find an opportunity to brag about what the security team's doing to the board, or at least maybe outside of the board to the rest of the C-suite? So it's not just only, hey, this is what the future looks like, and just focus on risk only.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. You know, what I will say, I'll give credit. I had a very good executive on the C-suite at my company who was able to provide me feedback and insight. And so that helped me develop and understand, you know, how to shift the information. I feel like there's way too many people that just don't have that. And so they're not getting the feedback, to your point. But I think we show the success of our team in a few different ways. I always present a roadmap of what we're trying to achieve. And I always have a slide in there of here's what we've accomplished over the last quarter. So we said we were going to go implement a new email system. So far, we've got it live for, 40%, and then we'll continue to show the metrics as we do that. Aaron, as you and I have done, this is my third rodeo of implementing an identity and access program, right? And that consists of privileged access management, advanced access management. We have IGA and all the things in it. So what we're showing in my board slides is the roadmap of how we're going to enable these capabilities and then the successes when we enable those capabilities and go along the way. I always joke around, though, because I think every security team, when we do our job well, that means no one else knows that anything's happening. So you're never going to get a pat on the back because we vetted it, right? We don't need to tell anybody because we did our job well. It's only when things go bad that people start to see you. So it is kind of like a thankless job. But, one of the incidents I've had to respond to, I would say the individual that, hey, we had this issue, the CEO of that entity, they put a call into IT and it was amazing. All of a sudden, all these people that I never knew existed come crawling out of the woodwork. And we see each other for the next 90 days or whatever it was, until everything's resolved and back up and running and all the things. And then you all went away. And he's like, I can't tell you how thankful I am that you guys were there, that you held our hand through it. But they're like, we never knew even you existed. I'm like, well, that's cool.
Thanks. That is something, actually, I didn't think about it until you're talking through it, is that working with you on some engagements, you say it's a thankless job. And I've worked with lots of different security teams, and I think they get that a lot. They're like, well, I'm just doing it. And they, I wouldn't say become disgruntled, but become a little more apathetic to their jobs and stuff. Working with you, though, you at the top aren't going to get thanks from the board, but you've always done a really good job of thanking everybody and giving direct feedback, both positive and negative, to make sure you're making positive traction overall. That is something else. So if we go back to the superpowers, that would be good for others to take on, is just being grateful to all those that support your role. It's something you've been really good at, or at least I've noticed.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I truly believe you can't be successful without a team. So it's all about the team.
I have a quick question. So clearly you have a high success rate. We've witnessed, your third iteration of deploying and managing full identity programs at very large enterprises and complex enterprises at that. So when you go to the board and when you go to your C-suite and you're asking for money or resources or people to solve the problems that you're trying to solve, usually the answer is yes. What do you do when they say no?
I kind of feel like if they say no, I didn't articulate the problem well enough to get the right answer. I mean, there's always going to be times where we say no because there's only so much budget. There's only so much time, right? And you can't do everything. But I honestly, it's hard because I very rarely hear no because we've got the right, we understand the risk and we know what we need to do. And people are generally supportive of mitigating those risks, right?
I've just noticed in your roles, you often get the budget you need, even if it's staggered. And a lot of that's because you are successful along the way, I feel like, right? So you deploy a tool and you can prove that it works. You show the roadmap and it sounds like you say you're not sending out all the noise, right? Of like, oh, I have to buy this tool to do it. Instead, you focus on what do you add to be successful and how does it map back to the risk? That's really, really good, Julie.
Thank you. I think it's all about what's doing what's best for the company, right? You've got to identify the risk. How do we mitigate the right risks? And what are we going to accept in order to potentially, we might have a cyber attack. So I think when you frame it as this is your business risk, this is how we mitigate it, and this is how we protect ourselves. There's certain things like identity and access management are no-brainers. I mean, that is the first layer of defense. When COVID hit, everybody went outside the network. So the old circles of trust thing that used to be really popular basically doesn't work anymore. And so if you don't have a good identity program and a solid foundation with identity, that's a huge risk to a company.
Right. So you were talking about the CEO of the business unit who was just like, oh, you came out of the woodworks. It's tough to be able to reach the entire business when it comes to security because they've all got, a lot of them are directly or indirectly generating revenue for the company, have other focuses. How are you able to reach them? So how do you promote security awareness throughout an organization?
Yeah, security awareness is a tough one because part of it depends on the company's culture. and how you can integrate into the company culture. And part of it is there's just required things that we probably need to do. And I can tell you, I learned a lot about this from a team member that recorded into me. Her name was also Julie. But she taught me a lot. And one of the things that she proposed and that we ended up implementing was a lot of gamification and making it fun. And so we implemented a phishing program that had badges that you could earn and reward that you could earn by reporting that phishing and not clicking on it. We actually even did gamify the training that we require people to do after clicking on it, as well as like you can earn, you're now phish aware, so you can earn these badges because it's not a bad thing you click, but now you know better, right? And so that program as a whole actually became very part of that company's culture, to the point where people would joke around with me that they got Meyerholzed. And I'm like, what does that mean? Well, I got Meyerholzed because I clicked on one of your fake phishings and I took your training. And so like, but it got people talking and it got people interested in cyber, which was a great thing that had happened at the company. Yeah, some of the other things that she did was gamified October Security Awareness Month. Like she set up a booth in the entry of the lobby with some cyber clues of what are the things that are wrong here, with like a password stuck to a desk and, you know, a couple other things, and had a gamification with it of, you know, if you come in and you do that and you submit the thing, then you can win prizes and learn along the way. So she really made it fun. And I learned a lot from her, and I've used that at other organizations as well.
That's just so cool, because I hear Tim talk a lot about not making like fear-based decisions, about putting positive spins on things. And it sounds like the Julies got together and basically said, hey, let's not punish people. Because I've certainly seen CISOs say, like, if you click, they track it. They say, if you click three phishing events, it doesn't matter who you are in the company, you're fired. And it's just very direct and over, but like to say, hey, let's not be afraid of every little mistake so that I can't actually open up any emails anymore. Let's make it fun. And that's just really cool to take the fear out of something, to say lessons learned, to get Meyerholzed. That says a lot about how much they trusted you and the security team to come back and admit, hey, I got Meyerholzed, and do it publicly. That says something about removing the fear in an organization around security. That's cool stuff.
So getting Meyerholzed feels a lot like one of the character topics we were talking about earlier, right? Is learning quickly. And that's a way to learn quickly without judgment, or, you know, if you get Meyerholzed three times, you're not getting fired, right? But you get Meyerholzed, you learn your lesson, and you don't click on the phishing email again. So what's interesting is one of my favorite authors is Simon Sinek, and he talks about change internally. And we always hear this quote, people hate change, people hate change. And he argues against that. He says, people do not hate change. People hate change to an unknown, right? And it sounds like, Julie, if you are teaching and coaching about what the future is, and you're making a game out of it, you're gamifying it, people don't hate change as much as we always thought they did. And so that is, you know, we can lump that into one of your superpowers as well, is the coaching and the storytelling and the teaching that you do influences change without the internal pushback. And that is what the best CISOs do.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that's another thing about that, is it's a lot more work. Saying you're going to get fired after three email attempts, that's a lot easier to track. I can imagine what you did was a whole lot more work, but I would assume that it was also, like, for Julie, it was probably fun, or the other Julie, it was probably fun to do. So I always hear CISOs like, I don't have time for extras, right? Or I don't have enough staff. How did you find the time to get people excited about doing this?
Yeah, I think going back to post-COVID, right, in probably 2015, 2016, you started to see the shift of SaaS. You saw cloud-based services, right? And then you had COVID and everybody went. So to me, culture and awareness is my first layer of defense, is actually knowing, having the people know the right thing to do at the right time. And then my first digital layer of defense is actually the identity, which we talked about earlier. So for me, it's making time for what is most important. And I would rather have a culture that is aware and knows what to look for and help prevent things than spend my time on a technical segmentation within the environment, because there's so many layers of security that they need to even get into that environment where if your users are unaware, they're going to be clicking on phishing. You're going to be constantly batting those molds that they pop up, and your team's not going to be effective. And so for me, it wasn't making time for extras. It was making time for what is most important for our overall security program.
That's pretty cool. Actually, I just realized I'm stealing a quote that I got from another CISO, but everybody is security. Can't remember who it was, but so I'm not going to name them, but everybody becomes security in that aspect. And so it ends up becoming an exponential, like, positive layer of being secure because everybody's a part of it. It's pretty great, Julie.
Did you say that the first line of defense is the people and the culture, and the second line of defense is the tools or the platforms that you're using to solve some of these problems?
Yeah.
That is flip-flopped from 99% of all CISOs out there.
Yeah, I know. I think I've used things differently, but you know, the more I see the culture and awareness programs work at different companies, the fewer incidents that my team starts responding to. Because you see, I mean, vulnerability management, the more that the people understand the why and the what, they're more willing to help you and go about it. You know, so for phishing, the more people that know what to look for and what not to do, or send it to me, I'll look at it and let you know if it's good. That protects the company. You know, it's easier to roll out a vulnerability management program when you have an awareness across the IT organization saying, yeah, these vulnerabilities are critical and they could be exploited to take down the company. They understand the why, and so they're more willing to support the program. So I think overall, the culture and awareness across the entire company, including information technology, is significantly important because that's your first layer.
Well, you hit the nail on the head with your first statement, right? You get to spend less money to solve the same problem with the same outcome. And that's exactly what we've been preaching that the best CISOs do. You still have to spend money. Thank you for that, by the way. You still have to deploy tools. You still have to hire the right people to manage these platforms and programs. But when you influence the internal culture, you do more with less. And that's what every CISO is tasked to do. And that's, by the way, I think that is why when you ask for money, you get it, because you do culture first and you lead first, like trying to save your organization's money. And when you ask for it, it's an actual need for the organization. So well done. Love that. Absolutely love that.
Well, I think we're going to have to give out trophies, Tim, for the podcast. So Julie can have the Humanizing Identity Culture Award.
This is why she's at the top of my list and your list.
Yeah.
I love it.
Okay, so I wanted to get into a little bit more around some more identity-specific stuff and your thoughts on where the future of identity was going. And so, like, what do you think the biggest issue today is in identity or in the future for identity?
Yeah, so identity is a complex one. And as we talked about, it's shifted in priority over probably the last 5 years, right? So there's a lot of legacy tech debt accents that I think companies are working with. And so cleaning that up is a problem within the organization. But also, I think non-human identities have never really been managed well at most organizations. And those are being leveraged more and more in cyber attacks. So those are some big risks that we need to get our arms around and start moving forward with. But with that said, I think the next big thing in identity, at least the things I'm seeing come down the pike, is I think it's very immature right now, but somebody will get it. Just-in-time access. And so having the right controls in place that maybe, Aaron, you don't need your access from 5 p.m. on Friday to 9 a.m. on Monday. So it automatically just turns off, so it's not there. And or we know that Aaron only works from Minnesota. So if anybody tries to log in from anywhere else other than Minnesota, your access just isn't there. And so I think with AI technologies coming down the pike and some of the innovation that is already starting to occur, eventually we will get to just-in-time access, which will make it even more difficult for an attacker to compromise a company.
I love that. And I think there's so many other areas that tie into it with like the fine-grain authorization tooling as well, just because there are so many permissions out there. And I don't know what to call it, but like, people generally think about just-in-time provisioning as like 2015 when Microsoft MIM came out, and it was like, oh, well, I'm going to request access and get approved and get access to an Active Directory group, but I'll only have it for a window. It's sunsetted after 3 hours, right? So, but it's still a workflow process where AI is not intended to be fully workflow driven, right? It's not just, oh, I make X, so Y happens. There's supposed to be a lot more variables into it and decisions around it. So I'm totally down for what you're talking about is the real just-in-time provisioning. I just don't know, like, is it like just-in-time 2.0? Like, what do we call it?
Right. 4.0. Just-in-time AI. I don't know.
Yeah, there you go. That's cool. So the non-human stuff, that's something else that's interesting too. Like, it's a growing need. And then like so much stuff with, so like IGA becoming an earlier part of identity as part of the history of identity that came after all of the mainframe and everything was developed to support identities and nobody, and then you had to manage it. So you had to go backwards into that. I felt really good about how like cloud platforms and infrastructure as a service was coming out and CI/CD pipelines. And that they were putting in cool controls around like authorization and around some amount of certificate management, among some other things that became, they were just thinking about identity, but they didn't really do the non-human identity stuff. So how do you go around like talking to your teams that maybe aren't under security around how do you protect like CI/CD platforms or CI/CD processes and other application development as part of non-human identities?
I gotta be honest, I'm still trying to figure that out. We're still working on it. But I mean, what we recently bought additional things with IGA to start to manage a lot of these non-human identities. So that way we can inventory them, understand what we have, you know, and then looking to integrate some of that with the PAM technologies as well. And we're putting our toe in the water right now, trying to mature that process. So, but I think they need to be managed in a similar way to human accounts because it is an account. It just doesn't have a human attached to it.
Right. It's tough to really manage. It's like the story we told on the first podcast about somebody deploying a PAM tool. PAM tools are generally inside of, or then we're focused on the security teams and infrastructure teams. So you had a direct relationship with those teams. And so they deployed, the short story is they deployed a PAM tool. Didn't get buy-in from the team. The team signed a petition and said, we're not showing up to work on Monday if you go live with this weekend. I can envision the same thing happening with application development teams inside the business of saying, what do you mean I can't hard code my credentials anymore? Or what do you mean I have to now build a process to do scans on my pipeline? Or that I have to make sure certificates never expire? Or that I've got to get another non-human identity for all of my 16 different non-prod environments. So I feel like that's going to be something we're going to have to do a lot of is that change management early. And that's something, maybe a final kind of question thinking through here. You've done some massive changes, that positive disruption. Do you have any stories around how you've changed an organization quickly and what that looked like when you were going to change how the business operated in the same way that somebody's going to have to do with non-human identities in the future?
Yeah. No, I think the appropriate story to tell is how I continued to make you uncomfortable as you were helping me roll out.
Oh, yeah.
In Access Manager.
That one. Okay.
That one. That was a fun journey that we went on. But I joined a company and they did not have multi-factor in place. And at that time, you know, I think it was 80% of the companies that were being breached did not have multi-factor in place. And so we wanted to move to a tool in the cloud. So I won't say the tool, but move to the tool in the cloud and enable multi-factor as fast as we could for 25,000 users. And Aaron came on board and he's like, we're going to do this in 6 months. This is what normal companies do. And I'm like, how about one? And he's like, how about five? And we landed on two. So we put a plan together and we turned on our sandbox. And from 2 months later, when we turned on the sandbox, we went live with 25,000 users with single sign-on for, I think we had 10 or 12 applications in it and multi-factor authentication. But the key to that was having organizational change and communication to all of those users throughout that whole time. And to your point earlier, Aaron, you were talking about, you know, how do you influence users to do what you wanted to do and you have the right behavior? We needed every user, all 25,000 of those users needed to register with the new system before we went live. And we needed to do it in a very short period of time because, like I said, we went live in 2 months. And so in order to incentivize individuals to actually give us the behavior that we needed, we started raffling off iPads which I never thought would be people would be so excited about as we did. So if you register early, you got in every raffle. And I think we did like six of them. If you registered later, then you missed out on the first couple raffles. But it really incentivized everybody, and people are really excited to move to the new technology because of the way we marketed it and kind of did gamification with it a little bit as well.
So people like iPads more than they dislike change.
Yeah, I think that is right.
25,000 employees, and we often talk about the buckets of people that you have to influence, right? You've got people who are apathetic, who just don't care. You have people who are fear-based, and you have people that are knowledge-based. And so I guess iPad is the median that crosses all of those groups.
I guess so. It was funny, though, because it still doesn't even do the whole justice of the full picture. We changed the entire first-time login process, rebuilt that, or we didn't. The team built over the mobile device certificates so it would work. We could log in on Macs. So we had to do upgrades on devices. There was a lot that went beyond, in addition to use another service provider for the existing SSO tool, a ton. Maybe if you could weigh an Active Directory, it was probably as many Active Directories, or there were probably 600 tons worth of Active Directory that we had to integrate with. So it was all of that. And then meanwhile, so that's all in 8 weeks from product signature to going live. There were two people, that one on our team and one on Julie's team, Lorna Davis and Christopher White, who built an entire change management process around it too. So they went, this was Julie's idea, but it went to each of the individual teams and walked them through demos so that they were ready for the change, walked them through how to register for MFA. So it wasn't just a send out a guide or a link to the vendor's website. It was a catered experience for everybody to do it. And that just goes back to what Julie said earlier about the culture piece, about tying into everybody. That was the first thing that was part of the roadmap, was how do we build the change management? How do we get free iPad? So that was a lot. And I want to add one more thing about I can't help myself, because it was such a fun time, but also it should have been terrifying. I was terrified the first time she said 8 weeks. I'm like, this is never a thing. I started off like, well, this job has been fun. We'll lose the contract. I'll go through. Most of the time, like we talk about it, like you can't do this stuff as an outsider by yourself. You have to get buy-in from the organization. Julie opened up the door to our organization and let us go in and make changes and empowered us to do so. And we did all of this work, and we get to the go live day, the week before go live. And two things happened in these 2 weeks. One was Julie was like, you know what? Instead of going live on Saturday, let's just go live on Monday when the users are there. Well, at the time in identity, you didn't go live with some mass change while the business was going on. Like during the day, go live, not tonight, a Monday night or something. No, during the day. And so that was a pretty big deal that Julie made us do there. I was so uncomfortable. I was like.
Yeah. And so the funny part about going live during the day is there were really good reasons for it. And I think it worked in our favor because we ran into issues. We knew we were going to run into some technical issues. So we waited for most of the users to log in. We started at 10 a.m.-ish or somewhere around there. So the team was refreshed. They had their coffee. They had their donut. They were ready to go. We started cutting over. And when we ran into some technical issue, which we knew we would, we had the right people available to us because it was the middle of the workday and they were at their desk or available remotely because they were working. And so it helped us go live faster and fix things faster because we didn't have to call somebody who may have been sleeping on a Saturday night or, you know, just trying to work through those technical issues. And I think the other thing that we learned, Aaron, is case sensitivity matters. That was a new one that we did not plan for. We planned for everything. But later in the afternoon, we started seeing failures with logins to VPN and could not figure out why those failures were happening. And what we found is that going back to account, like legacy tech debt, is some users' IDs were all in capital and some user IDs were created all in lowercase. Turns out, none of us knew this, that Palo Alto actually cares. So when you are trying to log into Global Protect, if the user ID doesn't match exactly how Palo expects to see it, the login fails. And so our team started scrambling because we had no idea what was happening. And it took us a while, but the team rallied. And because we started at 10 a.m. on a Monday at 4 p.m. on a Monday, we're still all refreshed. We're still working through it. And we figured out how to win the night. Aaron, you and I were joking around, like, we just sat in there. We're going to win this. We're going to figure it out. And we did. And then we all went out and had a beer after and celebrated. But it was a tense moment. We're like, oh, crap, do we have to roll back? But the whole team came together and we said, we're just going to do this. We're going to fix the problem. And we figured it out. And we ran some scripts. We changed the way the user IDs were done. And everything was fine.
That was great. And back to like being afraid about like going live during the day, I lost the fear early because like, we got this. You're like, well, I've got you covered. We're going to make it happen. The same thing that kept going with the whole team. And there was 25 or 30 of us in a room managing this go live, and every one of us was ready to go. We did everything like it was scripted. Everybody was on point, and I never was afraid of losing our jobs or having to refund you credit for services or anything like that, because it didn't feel like we were there just for the company or for my company. We were there for each other as a team. And that was something that you inspired in everybody in that room. And that was pretty powerful. And like you said earlier, it just starts with culture. It starts with wanting to be part of that team, because we're all people at the end of the day. We like being a part of the team. So it's something I really appreciate about that process and all of the stuff we work together with, Julie.
No, it's all about the humans, right? Without the humans, nothing gets done. So we had a lot of fun with that implementation because it was either laugh or cry. So you might as well laugh, right?
Right or well left. In closing here, Julie took us out. Well, on two different things. We got to do a bourbon tour. It was a great time. But as a team, we all played Whirly Ball. And that was, if you haven't played Whirly Ball, look it up. Find some time to go play at some point. It is bumper carts meets lacrosse meets basketball. And there was some pent-up aggression that was released against each other. Lots of team, lots of laughs, lots of beer. And I would say one of the best qualities about Julie as we close up here is that she brings out the best in her people. And that is something that I would ask all CISOs to do. And it's really hard. You've got a thankless job, but being thankful to those around you and bring out the best of them is, in fact, one of Julie's superpowers. Thanks, Julie, for joining us. We appreciate you. And I look forward to keep working together.
No, thank you so much. I enjoyed the conversation, guys, and you're making me blush.
Cool. Thank you.
You too.
Cheers.
Thank you for joining us in this episode of Authenticate This, the Cybersecurity Leadership Podcast. Check out the show notes for links and resources mentioned in today's shows. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss on any future episodes.